Accession number 9202, rule number 1.
Mr. Ray, Reel 1. Could you tell me something about your background before the war, Mr. Ray?
Shall we start at the beginning?
Yes, you mean
when I was a child, or just living in the country?
Just as you like.
Just as we like. Well, I was born... Is that necessary? I was born at... I cannot be quite sure about this, but it was either Pelton Fell in Durham, Chester Street, Durham, Pelton Fell, and after, say, a couple, 2 or 3 years there, the family moved to a small village, Peelaw Grange, which was in the main turnpike between Newcastle and Durham. See? Now the nearest towns was on the north side was Birtley, and south, about a mile and a half away, Chester Lee Street. Now I mustn't forget Chester Lee Street, because people think that it's just a small, out-of-the-way place. But actually, in church history, from the very early commencement of church history, it played an important part. Because St. Cuthbert, who came from, he was connected with Lindisfarne, which was on the Northumberland coast. And he, in those days, you see, they used to make a big to-do about taking care of people who were great churchmen, shall I say, you know. And this Cuthbert, St. Cuthbert he was, he came, his body was interred after he died. It was interred at the town, in the town, in the church at Chesterley Street, and afterwards at Durham. Now, I must break off here, because while I'm making a point of this town, it was the town where I was, we eventually went to live there, after living in the country. But it was while living in the country that I began my work as a coal miner. I started when I was 14 years of age. But at the time, before starting there, my two sisters and myself, we still travelled by foot to this small town of Chesterley Street every day. And it was about a mile and a half to walk. And to go to the school, I went to the boys' school, naturally, and the sisters, they went to a Church of England school. Now I went to an elementary school which had just passed out of taken over from the church influence, if you put it that way, into the council jurisdiction. See? But we still had the overlordship of the rector of the parish. The rector of the parish used to come to the school. And we had to go once a year, especially on Ascension Thursday, to the church of St. Cuthbert for Ascension Day. See? So I'm saying this because we wanted to keep into... we had to keep in line with the church. We weren't fully we weren't fully, say, shall I say, taken over by the council, as it were. See? Now, to jump quite a distance ahead to when we were engaged in Gallipoli, we were sailing up the Aegean coast, which was on the port side of the Gallipoli Peninsula. You know the Aegean Sea. The Aegean Sea is on that, looking at the map. It is on the left, isn't it? And we were assembled there on the deck, and the platoon officer, whose name I can't remember, but it transpired that this man, he was our MVR officer, but he came from the Argentine. And what I couldn't understand, when he took our names and addresses, and he came to me, and I gave him my name, so and so, 9 Relton Terrace, Chesterley Street, and I said, County of Durham, and he checked me. He said, you don't need County of Durham. He said, anyone who knows this church history knows where Chesterley Street is. And what surprised me was that I think that man was connected with some unit that was established in the Argentine, in Buenos Aires, you see, and they volunteered to come to England against Germany, and that was as far as that goes. But to return now to this school at Chesterley Street, where I went there, I was going to an infant school before I was 5 years of age at this Peel of Grange. There was a church, a mission school, and my sisters and I went there, and we're still living in the country, of course. My father was a mineral manager on the North Eastern Railway. Now, he had what you would term, even in those days, a very good job. But like all the men that I knew, if they got anywhere at all, it meant that they had to burn the midnight oil to get into any position. And he was in charge of a district. He had charge of the coal that came from various collieries into one huge siding, and it was his job to see that everything was ship-shape and Bristol fashion, and this type of coal and steam coal and other coal and the various types put into truckloads and into sets, and where they were dispatched to Tyne Dock, or you know, down to the east coast of Sunderland and thereabouts, you see. And that was his occupation. And of course, we lived there, but we lived on the estate of the Earl of Durham, and we lived there until my father died when I was about 13 years old. At that time, if you were at school, you were reached 13 years of age, you could sit what was termed a labour examination. In my case, at that age, I was as far in my school training as I could get. I was in what was termed Standard X7, and they didn't seem to be interested in any further education for me. That seemed to be the idea. So my mother, of course, being a widow, we decided I should be looking out for a job. So I asked my mother, I said, would she speak to an uncle who worked at a colliery, ask if I could go down the pit for a shift, for one shift with him, to see what it was like. And people, even in those days, who were not connected with the mines, they thought it was rather a bit out of the order of things for me to want anything like that, because no one wanted to go down the mine when they left school. However, I had this accepted, and my uncle took me down, and I had a shift with him and saw how things were, and I decided that I would like to go down the pit. So after a preliminary few weeks working at the pit heap, you know, top of the pit, I was drafted down into the pit itself, and from then I started working there, and I went through various stages of different kinds of jobs.
Could you tell us some of the jobs that you did? What involved?
Oh, well, yeah. First of all, when I began on the screens in the first instance, I was doing any kind of job, because we were all looked upon as being tender lads at that time. I was the one. I used to go. They used to send me around once or twice, to the blacksmiths, or they send me around to the carpenters. Were a cap full of nail holes, something daft like that, you see. And I would go around for this cap full of nail holes and things like that. I was very interested in how the thing worked, because I used to observe that the coal coming up in the tubs and the empties going down. And what happened to the coal when it was up, how it went down what was termed the jiggers, and the coal was divided from the large lumps of coal into the very small dust. And it used to go along a belt, and the men there who had been incapacitated through any form of ill health or accident or anything like that, they used to divide the coal and select and pick out all the stone and rubbish that was in the coal, and so on. And as it went down, the coal was divided with this form of a jigger or a shaker, where there were the small coal fell through and the large coal ran along on this endless belt, and it tipped over into the trucks, and that was how they were filled, this 10 tons and 15 tons and later on 20 ton trucks of coal. And this is the screens. Now, I also learned that how they found out who had filled these particular tubs of coal. And it was done by the man at the coal face using a token and putting it on the inside of the, on a staple inside the tub, So that from that, when the column stepped up at the bank head, they knew by the token who had filled that column. And that was checked. There were two important points here. The first being the official weighman was the owner's rep. The men's rep was termed a check weighman. And it was his job to see that the man got, there was no fluffing the beetle or whatever, you know, stealing the march or not getting, the man not getting his rightful due to the amount of coal which he had filled.
What was it like when you actually went underground?
And then when I went down the pit, set me straight away, just being a more or less a boy, to trapping, what was termed trapping. These were doors, wooden doors, that I had to open for those that were, anyone coming through that was driving a pony with a tub or tub, you see. And that was just a short period. And after I got my eyesight and I'd got into the thing a little bit, it was then that I was given the pony to pull the tubs in and out to a siding. That carried on for maybe about a year. The next job I had was riding. It was what was termed run riding, and it was one of the most dangerous jobs there was in the pit. Now I had to run, meet this set of tubs that was hauled from the shaft to the right end on the rope, a main rope and a tail rope. And I used to catch the set, jump on the last tub on the rope and go right in to the district where it was going. It was my job to see that none of these tubs, if they got off the way, it was my job to be able to just to drop off and with an overhead wires that were fixed to the roof of the seam, be able to work them so that I could notify the man at the shaft bottom to stop the shaft, stop it, you see. And then proceed from that if it was a very serious business. Well, of course, there were ways and means of putting things right, you see. And that was why it was such a dangerous job, because the man that was breaking the motors, and they were electric motors, there was also steam, but the steam motor, well, they were both motors. The electric motor was worked to the bottom of the shaft. The electric motor was the bottom of the shaft, yes. This job was a very interesting job, because even though it was a dangerous job, I had a telephone. And in those days, you would never think that there would be a telephone ever so far down the pit shaft, down the pit. And we call it going in by. Now, this telephone that I worked, also, it was situated where I had to change the ropes manually by, you know, just to go to another district, and vice versa. And it was really up to me to see that when this worked, this had to work right. There was no question of forgetting to put the points or not put the points in their proper order. Otherwise, there would have been a real smash up. And that took, quite a bit of time up, because to change the ropes was rather a tough job for a youth. However, as I said, it was interesting from that point of view, and it was something which stayed with me for quite a long time, the interest in it, although it was dangerous. Well, as time wore on, and not very long afterwards, the back overman. When I say the back overman, the man who was he was in charge, but he was in charge in the back shift. And he said to me, "From in future, you'll have to walk and not ride. It's too dangerous." Oh. So he said, I was forbidden, and I had to ride. I had to walk instead of riding. Right. So I'd rather put the damper on things. But anyway, when he wasn't there, I used to sneak a ride in and out, sneak a ride. And that was the only way. Well, that lasted for quite a while. And anyway, quite a long story short, I was at this particular colliery about 1910, and I left, and I got the job in another colliery, which was not so far to walk, and it was nearer home. Naturally, it wouldn't be from so far to walk, I'd soon be near home, wouldn't it? Anyway, this colliery, I had an accident, and I was driving a pony with two tubs down an incline, and at the top of the incline there was a siding where the man with his pony from the coal face brought his tubs there, and instead of him putting a sprag in the wheel when he brought it out, he just unloosed his pony off there and left it. And I'm going down this incline, and I had to have sprags in all the wheels because it was so steep. And this tub ran amain and dashed into my tubs and upset me, you know. And I was pinned there between the shafts of the pony and this tub. Now, there for about half an hour, I couldn't move. Also in the dark, my life had gone out. And I was there for about half an hour, and it happened to be there were men were changing their ship. They were coming in to relieve the men that were in, fortunately for me. And when they saw the situation, of course, it was a matter of only about 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour, before they got me loose. And one man, it'll tell you how small I was, he carried me in his arms to the bottom of the shaft, because we were not too far away from the shaft. And it was in the days before there was no national health insurance. So they put me in a tub, pulled me up, out of the pit, put me into what was termed a coal cart. And these coal carts used to be used for carrying the coal to the miners' houses. The miners getting free coal, and that was what they used the coal carts for mainly. They did use them for other things, but that was mainly what the idea was. They took me home, right through the town in a coal cart. There was no one bothered about. No, it wasn't a question of seeing a doctor. No, and this was, of course, this was before national health was ever thought of. It was a couple of years before, because it was in 1912 when that Lloyd George's National Health Insurance came in, wasn't it? So, I got home. And my mother just accepted this, you know, people just used to accept it as part and parcel of the day. Anyway, I was laid off for a month, because my mother had to go and get the doctor. And the doctor came and he said, he reckoned all I wanted was a good stay in bed. So I had about, I was off a month. Then I went back to work again, same bit again. And that went on like that. See, and I went through the various stages. I went from being a driver and running the sets to a stone putter. That meant working at night work. With the men who were working stonework, because in certain parts the seams of coal were not thick enough, and the stone had to be cut out, cut out by shot fires, or it had to be cut out by the men, but they had to work it so that they could fire their shots and loosen the stone so that you could have space to work in to get the coal out. And I was on stone putter for about 12 or 18 months. So, and then after that I set on coal putting. And of course all this time, you know, with coal putting, and the men at the coal face, they were on piecework. No such thing as datal work. The datal workers were the men that just worked on the engine plane, on the wagon way, and the odd job men that you saw moving about, you see. And that went on for...
What was coal putting?
Coal putting?
Yeah, what did you do?
Well, the coal putting meant that you had to supply the man that filled the tubs with the coal. You had to supply him with the tubs, you see. You'd find a man or two men working in one part, and you'd have several men, and you'd have to keep them supplied.
With tubs?
With tubs. And the same thing applied with stone, but not to that extent.